just going to say that today is the 12th of December, and this is my first interview with Clarence Phillips at his home on Carey Place. Okay, Mr. Phillips, would you please begin by telling me about your family background?
Well, I'll start off like this. I was born March the 30th, 1892. And I have a brother and sister, but they passed away before my time. I didn't know anything much about them. And my father's name was Samuel, and my mother's name, which I always get it wrong, whether I read it was Annie or Margaret. And I was born in Camden, New Jersey, on Ross Street. And my mother died at the age of, how was I? Oh, yes. My mother died about at the age of 4 years old. I was 4 years old when mother died.
How old was she when she died?
I don't know. I don't know how old my mother was. I never got a record of her. And the people that my grandmother yielded to a great deal, they weren't acceptable as me as a child in my mind, because they were doing the things that I don't think about doing the day that they did, that they're doing this day that they did in those days back then. That is drinking and carousing and rough stuff, you know. See? And they were very nice to me to a certain extent, because I had to be sitting on the stool while they drank and ate their pretzels and potato chips and give the boy some. And I'd sit there and join them like, but it wasn't what I was looking for, because I didn't know what it was all about. And in those days, men had the lunch kettles, square lunch kettles, with a screw top on the lid, whereby they could screw that, and they could fill that up with beer or coffee or tea or chocolate, any kind of drinks. Most generally, you go down to the saloon and you could get, for 10 cents, you could get that whole kettle filled up for 10 cents. And that would serve everybody around that's in there drinking. Well, so much for that. But as time ran along, I never realized the death of my mother until we were out. My father and I was out, and I saw a group of children with a white woman leading a group, colored and white children, and a white woman in the front and one in the back. And my father and I, we were going to our black church. Always out walking. I can't hardly tell you where it was in the beginning. So anyway, I said to my father, "Hey," I said, "where are they going? I'd like to go with them." And he says, "You'll go with them later on." I said, "We can't go now. Tomorrow," said I, "may." He says, "I may take you over there and let you see them." So Monday come along. Well, sure enough, he got off his job and took me over there Monday afternoon. And I was glad to be with those children, and I played like the devil playing those children. But that night when I went to bed, I cried nearly all night long for my father. You see, because he and I were just like pals, and I missed him. At that time, I figured my age must have been about five or six. 6 years old, see. And as time rolled on, I got very much attached to the orphan home, most especially when I found that they had a schoolhouse on the playground. Then I was introduced to the man. They had a man teacher, and he was the principal of the school, and he was just as nice to we kids as could be. And I will always remember him till death takes me from this earth. He taught me how to make my alphabet, and most especially, he showed me how to make the letter Q. you see.
Why the letter Q?
The letter Q was hard for me to make because he says, make a nine. And he showed me how to make a nine, and I made a nine. And the next time he, when I wrote it down, the next time he came back and he says, now, he says, that is good. He says, now, that's not quite a Q, but he says, lest we put a tail on it. So he said, get in the bottom, and he showed me, come up with like that. And that's all he kept doing that there. And I kept doing it on the paper till they got the Q.
Were you considered one of the bright children? Did he pick you out?
Well, seemingly he did in regards to the alphabet. For one thing, I'll tell you what occurred as time progressed was that we had the well, I will say we had a writing course, penmanship, and then we had the two ways by this teacher teaching us how to write. And ever since I've become a man, I've always thought that her idea was to get what kind of penmanship, how are we going to write, vertical or Spencerian, you see. So I fell in love with vertical, but as I grew older, I liked Spencerian more than I did vertical, you see. And every afternoon, there would always be two women come there. They had special days, something like, I hardly knew what days were, like Thursday or twice a week they would come there. And they were WCTU, I think that's what it is. Women Christian Temperance Union. That's what the word, see? And they had that a little white cross, they had a little white cross pinned on the lapel of their coats. Now, we were to learn portions of the Bible, and then we were to clap our hands and say, I don't know what the first part of it, but the last part was, saloons, saloons, saloons must go. So saloons had to go.
What year would you say that was, that the WCTU women came?
Well, I think that I must have been either 7, 8, or 9 years old. That's about that age. That's where it was located. And there's where she would come in. I mean, they would come in. Their days were supposed to be there, and give us instructions not to drink. They'd give us instructions never smoke, and they would give us instructions to tell the truth, and not to be sassy, and be obedient. Well, we kids, we took all that along and liked it pretty good. Now, you got bread and milk. You got bread and milk, understand me now. You got bread and milk morning and night. Midday meal, you would get cabbage. Maybe you'd get the bologna. Rice pudding and bird nest pudding was the favorite dessert. And also, you'd get gingerbread. Gingerbread was great, but that bird nest pudding, that was it. That's all.
What is that?
Bird nest pudding? I think I've been trying to figure out. I wonder if I could make it, and I wonder if some of the cooks of today, I wonder if they can remember what bird nest pudding was. Bird nest pudding was a big pan about like that, long pan, and it was cake dough, mixed up some kind of cake dough, but it had I can taste it now, that was a lovely taste of pudding, and it had some kind of a sauce over. Now, the sauce could be made of cooks of the day would make any kind of sauce, like a lemon sauce, or chocolate sauce, or the white of an egg sauce, anything that put on top of the topping. And then it was cut in little blocks, 2 by 2.
Did somebody serve you your meals?
And that was served. That was served to us
in the school, or in the orphanage.
In the orphanage. See, well, I'm talking about the orphanage now. This is not the Hampton Institute at all.
Right, but the school was right on the ground.
They had a school. They had a school building on the ground.
Okay.
And the grade went to about seventh grade, sixth and seventh grade.
Give us the full name of the orphanage.
West Jersey Orphanage for Destitute Colored Children. That's what it said. That was the sign. See?
How many were
between 6th and Liberty and Mechanic Avenue in Camden, New Jersey.
Is it still there?
That I don't know. I've got some letters I started to write to the different ones who have been there. But to my amazement, when I came here to Port Washington, a friend of mine was working for the Wysongs in this town. Wysongs came here. Are you a Port Washington resident?
Yes.
How long have you been here?
Only 5 years.
Well, you don't know anything about them.
I know the Wysongs.
Yeah, you know of the Wysongs.
I know
Wysongs.
About them, yes.
Yeah. Well, I forget what his first name
Allison?
Was.
Allison?
I believe it was. His wife mm-hmm. was related to one of the matrons that was over me. And she had a young man that had been cooking and serving them in her house for about 10 or 12 years or more. And there were some things that were given to a home. I don't know whose home it was given to. It was given to some private home from the Wysongs. It was something like an ice box. And accidentally, Mrs. Wysong and I got into a conversation. See? And one word brought on another, and I was telling her the first time about Port Washington and how long I'd been in Port Washington. And I was telling her who raised me, and she said, where were you born? And I told her, and it drifted, and then I told her about Miss Haynes and Miss Matlock and Miss Haynes. They were the women that were there, but no there were no men in there, see. So I was telling Mrs. Wysong about these two women. Now, one of those women were related to Mrs. Wysong, but I don't know which one was. Now, I understand Mrs. Wysong's dead now, I understand. They went to Florida. They moved me and went to Florida.
Yes.
And I understand she's dead. But, you know, I felt good to know that there was somebody that knew the people where I was in this orphan home, you see?
Yes.
And I longed time after time to have another talk with Mrs. Wysong. Because, in other words, as a child and as a young man, as I went along when I was here, I had lots that I could have told her that went on there. See, because of
yes, can we get back to the orphan home?
Yeah, I'm still in the home.
I want to hear more about it. How many children were there?
The children went anywhere around from 45 to 55 children. See, the very large dining room, mm-hmm. and they had three long tables in the dining room, and so many children sat there, and we were served by the cook, and they had a cook there. The cook lived next door to the home, and the cook would come and serve us, and also the matron and her assistant would come and serve us. While we were eating, we always would notice each other how we eat. So we struck one boy named Wooly Cork. He would never chew a white potato, and it seemed as though the larger the white potato was, we he could swallow and he saw his white potato. And we used to wonder, how in the world does he manage to swallow a whole white potato? And we told the tale to the matron, Willie's not chewing his potatoes. He's swallowing the potato. Our seats, we had no chairs at the table. We had long benches, and we all sat on the bench. So she made the child move one side, and she sat down alongside of Willie Corcoran and have white potatoes, and then she would watch him, and soon when he'd get ready to eat the potato, and she would tell him, put that potato down now. Bench that potato with your fork, and put it in your mouth, and eat your potato. She would never let him escape trying to put a whole potato in his mouth. He was going to put the whole potato. He had his spoon in his mouth, get his mouth wide open, put it down there, but she wouldn't stop him.
What did you do? You must have been
I tell you one thing about me. I was a goody-goody boy to a certain extent for the reason the money that my father was paying, he's paying for me $9 a week, a dollar and a half a week, I think. I'd almost forgot that money now. It'll come to me again. I may have, I don't know. What was I going to say?
You were goody-goody.
Yeah. I went along. I studied my lessons very well. I learned everything very well in school. I ate everything that they had given me, with the exception I didn't like hominy. If I didn't eat hominy, that was all I was going to get. So I broke my intros to learn how to eat hominy. But then when I went off to school, well, then I didn't bother. I would get back to school again. The hominy was good, and rice pudding was very good, and the food that came in there was fish on certain days. And then we'd have most of the eating all the time would be beef stew or lamb stew. Very, very seldom you got any chicken coming down the pipe. See, there's no chicken, good necessary for any meat. And we used to have anywhere around from, well, I'd say 80 quarts. We have 2 40-quart milk cans would come there sometimes twice a week. Well, that's all we kids would do, was drink up milk, bread and milk, because everybody got fed milk. Then, bread and milk. Then it got so, I was growing. I'm only talking about Phillips now. I was growing, and I was in, my appetite was being increased to the extent I wasn't getting enough to eat. See? I couldn't fill them things up down inside of me and keep them filled up, see? And my father used to come and see me once and twice a week. I'll talk about myself and him too later on. He would come, but he'd always bring me a bag of something to eat. He'd bring me peanuts. I was a lover of peanuts. And the Frankfurters, oh my, we didn't call them hot dogs in those days. We called them Frankfurters, you see. Well, the Frankfurters in those days were very nice and tasty in comparison to the Frankfurters that we're getting now, because the Frankfurters that we're getting today is made out of everything but what the Frankfurters made in those days when I was a kid coming along. Yet they were very good. And then he would bring me 3 or 4, maybe a half a dozen sometimes, of egg biscuits. You ever know what egg biscuit is? Well, egg biscuit looked like ordinary biscuits that they had, but they had the egg biscuits was made out of eggs, and the edges of them had ears on them, flop up like you would crimp a pie around the edge, you know.
Yes.
Only the cook would take and bring them edges up all around. See. My father would stop at the bake shop and bring me these egg biscuits, and they were delicious. Oh, I was crazy about egg biscuits. And then he would bring me bananas and sometimes fruit, oranges. And then I would get what boys and girls that I liked best in there. I would always say, all my party boys and girls, come on, we're going to have a party. And then we'd get somewhere and we'd eat up these egg biscuits or we'd eat up these frankfurters. And but you have to do like I'm going to do. And I'd hop and skip around and they followed me all the way around there. And we'd act like monkeys, you know. And we didn't know we act like monkeys in them days, as I'm talking about now. So we thought that was something great. And we got to play in the... well, it was like this here. I loved a certain group of them. And then every boy and girl in the home always had his pals, a group. Maybe I'd have about five or six kids playing with me. We would be playing some kind of game that would require six kids. We were always singing London Bridges Falling Down and Little Mary Had a Little Lamb and Old Mother Hubbard Went to the Cupboard and then would ask little riddles and things like that. And then there would always be other groups would be doing the same thing.
Was it mixed boys and girls?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, mixed boys and girls. And the thing of it is, they would play, the yard was big enough for everybody to play in there, and I was playing with one group of children, and here was another boy, he was playing with another group of children. Now, my group that I was playing with didn't know a thing about what that other group was playing, and they were on the other side of the property or around the other side of the house. They were playing, and we were playing on, I will say something like this here. We were playing on Liberty Street side in the Orphan Home, and this other group was playing on the Mechanic side street in the Orphan Home, see? Because it was a big building. And I ran away from my bunch and see if they could find me. Well, in the meantime, running, dashing around the building, this other gang was playing dashing around the building too, and we with my gang didn't know it. So by me running around and they run around, our heads come together and busted me out of the way where the mark is now. I got hit over the eye. That boy, he had a hard head, whoever it was, knocked me over the eye, and blood just spattered, that flew out everywhere. And they had to call Dr. McAllister to come from, well, I don't know where Dr. McAllister, he lived up on Federal Street in Camden, New Jersey. And he came down, they didn't have an automobile, he came down in his horse and carriage. And he came in, and he put in a few stitches. Now, I don't know how many stitches put in there, but I had to...
It looked like there might have been about 10 over the left eye.
I had a whack of a...
Did your father find out about it?
No. Well, when my father come, told him father, my father didn't raise no sand about it. He said, you have to be careful and play. And the matron was sorry that I got like that there. The matron told her just how it all happened with the children playing. And my father didn't raise no sand. I think my father paid $9 a week for my room and board.
Hmm. Where was your father living at the time?
My father, at the time... my father was living on a street called Kane Avenue.
And did he live by himself?
No, he didn't live. After my mother died, he didn't live long. He didn't stay long on Kane Avenue. They both. You see, I think if my memory serves me right now, that my mother and father lived together. They weren't separated. They were roughly together. But he stayed in this house where it was. It seems to me that it was on Kane Avenue. I am not exactly sure of that. And
is that the house you lived in before you went to the orphanage?
Yes, sure. I never lived. I might have lived in that house. I don't know what house I was living in. I was born on Orchard Street in Camden, New Jersey, you see.
And then after that, they moved to Kane Avenue?
Then after that, my father and I went to Cane Avenue. But my father, in a way of going around, my father didn't stay long at anyone's house. If my memory serves me right, he and I were always going around from house to house, to people's house to house, because he was looking for somebody to take care of me. You see, at the age of 6 years, he wanted somebody to look out for me. So finally he did strike a woman. Where in the world did she live? I can't place where she lived. Her name was Mrs. Havilow. And I was taken care of by Mrs. Havilow. My father would always come around and visit me nearly every day around about noontime to see how I'm getting along.
What was he doing at the time?
He was driving. Now, this is another thing you got to get good. He was driving a two-wheel cart with one horse attached to it. My father would get up early in the morning and go down to Cane Avenue Ferry. This is where the train was down there, Cane Avenue, somewhere down near the ferry. But my father would always get up early in the morning and go down, curry the horses off and feed the horses. He never wanted the stable man to touch his horse. My father was a dear lover of horses. And as time rolled on, the company went into Coke business. See, advertising Coke. And for to have it advertised, as near as I can hear people talking, my father drove 8 head of horses for 19 years. You see? And all the spangles and rings, ivory rings, and the bells and the tassels all come out of my father's pocket. The company didn't defray. My father was tickled by the horses that he decorated the horses and take his money that they would pay him. He was only getting $9 a week, I think, of salary or wages. But he would take the money and decorate the horses. And he was advertising to Coke because the wagon would be all decorated up, you know. And he had to deliver Coke at where he had been delivering the coat before with the cart, one horse the cart. This time he was delivering the coat with 8 head of horses. You see, and my father didn't know his name from Adam's house cat. You see, but he knew where to deliver all the coat, and sometimes it would always be everybody would be gone home when he come out off of the route. Everybody in the office would be gone. And my father would be there left alone. And my father always carried a pistol. So when he put his horses up, feed his horses, he would go to the office, lock the office, take his pistol out and lay it on the desk there. So if anybody bothered him, he's going to let them have it anyhow. And sometime he would bring anywhere around from $1,000 to $2,000 in. And he carried the money. And it was nobody there for him to turn the money over to. So he'd stay there all night until somebody come at there to for him to give him the money.
Do you remember the name of the company? No,
it was at that time it was Farr and Bailey. Farr and Bailey used to be used to make oilcloth. Linoleum as a company by the name of Farr and Bailey, but the company whom he worked for was Camden Coke and Gas Company at that time. That was it. Now, and that's why that I would like to write to some of those. See, that's the reason I wanted to see Mrs. Wisehound, because I could have talked to Mrs. Wisehound in order to find out if the Coopers were still in business, because the Coopers. One had sold coke and lumber and hardware and stuff like that, and the other Cooper brother was a lawyer. Howard was a lawyer. Well, I knew those two men, and our doctor for the home, for this orphanage, he was his name was McAllister. Well, let's go back to to my father and poison. Now,
can you describe your father? What he looked like?
My father was a short, brown-skinned man. With a heavy mustache, but this is the part. My father always wore the handlebar mustache. You know the handlebar mustache?
Yeah.
And he always would keep them sharp, stand out like that. Even if he drove up, they always had to be out there. And
was he a strong man?
He was very strong. He was very strong. I'm going to tell you, I'm coming up to his death. And there's something there that I wanted to tell you about him. But he would, as I say, he would come and visit me nearly every night when he get to work. He'd keep that visiting coming. So one afternoon, he got off early, as I can remember. He came to me, and he was leaving, going out the gate. They had a high fence. In those days, they had paling fences. No wire fence. Had paling fence, and they all had to be whitewashed. And as he went to the gate, going out down the path, and got out the gate, opened the gate, I told him I wasn't getting enough to eat. And why did I tell him that? He turned around and come on back up there and went in there and talked to some women folks and told them, look here, I'm paying so and so and so for my child in here, and he says he's not getting enough to eat, and I believe he's not getting, I want my child fed. Feed him. And he laid the law down there to them, and they told him, and I, don't you know, I never had any more trouble. I always got a little extra more on my plate than anybody else. That's the reason I think today that I'm such a hog and eating out. I love to eat. I love to eat, yes indeed. And I got to branch off from there just a little bit, but I have to tell you about this. See, when I come out the orphan home, when I got 13 years of age, the home then, the matrons had a talk with my father and told me that he'd have to take me out of there because I was getting too old, and they offered to pay me so much a week to take care of the furnace. And my father says, no, he says, I don't want my boys. He says, I want to send my boy off to school. And my father went to and asked the teacher, I guess I'm a little ahead of myself as far as the teacher concerned, because after I had learned the alphabet, my man teacher, didn't stay there long with me. The next teacher came in there was a woman, and her name was Locke. I have to tell you about that because that was very good. What I like about that, their name was Locke, and she had a son. I might as well tell it right along as I go about Locke. Don't you be talking to yourself in there, Mama. You stop talking to yourself.
You talk to your lady and don't finish. Keep your
ass
and get
out of my business. Well, Mrs. Locke, she lived 417 Stevens Street in Camden, New Jersey. Well, that was my school teacher. And she had a son that was attending Northeast High School on Broad Street in Philadelphia. And out of a class of 500 students at that school, Northeast High School, he was the only one that received a scholarship to go to Oxford, England, to school. That's what I want to get in there. See, because I thought he was great. And I've always known Alien Leroy Locke. That was his name, Alien Leroy Locke. Alan Leroy Locke, Alan, whatever they call him, Leroy Locke. Well, I was taken to death to know that he went to school, and out of a class of 500, he was the only one that received the scholarship to go to Oxford, England. And he went there and studied to be a professor. He graduated out of England and then took a job at Howard University in Washington, D.C., professor of history. I was like, someone's from Leroy.
How did you know him if he didn't go to your school?
Because
of his mother telling you?
No. You see, he used to come, when he would come on his vacation or when school was out, instead of him going home 417 Stephen Street when his school was out on Broad Street, he would come to the orphanage where his mother was teaching.
I see.
Then he and his mother, both of them, they'd go home together. So that's how we got acquainted. That's how I got acquainted with Alien Leroy Locke. But I have to tell you this because my mind has been disturbed ever since they had the. I have to put this in there. Ever since the National Association of Advancement of Colored People had a youth group in there, and our niece here in Port Washington was a member. Two nieces we had. That was a member of the youth group. And they had a conference in Washington, D.C., where the National Association of Advancement Youth Group had to go there. In the meantime, I had written a letter to Alien Leroy Locke. Take this letter, and I am introducing you to Mr. Locke. And I put everything that happened to me in that orphan home so as to attract his mind and let him know that I knew who he was. You see? Well, my niece. That's my wife's niece. She carried the letter there and gave it to his secretary. In the meantime, he wasn't there. He had gone on a business trip to his school in England, Oxford, England. You see? Then when he came back, instead of him being a gentleman, now I'll show you where some people's got so much education, they ain't got enough to come in out of a shower of rain. You see? Now he being a well-learned man, a college man, and I number a little poor boy, and I write a note to send to him. He should have at least wrote to me, because I was living in this house then. But I heard no more from him. See? And I used to wonder why. And I didn't write down there to find, because the letter was enough, and the secretary should have given the letter to him, but she didn't. So that was all I know of Alien Leroy Locke. What?
How many years ago was that you wrote the letter?
Oh,
I
ain't got nothing here. Let's see.
You were already in Port Washington?
I was already here in Port Washington.
Okay.
And when the National Association of Advancement of Colored People opened up a branch here in Port, in Roslyn, in Great Neck, that gave them a chance when they met here in Port Washington, and I knew that the youth group was going to go down to Washington, D.C.
Right, I'll try to date it.
Yeah,
that.
You'll you'll get a date someplace.
Was his
way
mother
back
a
there.
Good teacher?
Huh?
Was his mother, was Mrs. Locke a good teacher? Did
oh,
she take special interest in you?
Oh, she was a lovely teacher. Yeah, she was a lovely teacher.
What do you remember most about her?
I used to like to go up there and help her to clean house. I was a houseboy, you see. And then, after her husband died, I didn't know Mrs. Locke became infatuated with a man by the name of Webb. So, at least I was growing. I wasn't in an orphan home then when Webb started browsing around her. So, this is a roundabout twist up thing because I want to get back to the orphan home.
Okay, well, let's get back to it. Let's talk about...
Well, wait. This man teacher that I had, Mr. Cornish, his name was Malcolm, but anyway, his name was Cornish. Mr. Cornish was my teacher. And he also had a dry goods store, a clothing store, dry goods store, on Cane Avenue in Camden, New Jersey. And he, as much as I know, he had a wife and child. But at the same time, he was also a teacher at the school where I was in the orphan home. See? Now, when he left, another woman came in to teach us. And to my amazement again, her name was Phillips. But I didn't know her. My people didn't know her, see. But in this orphan home, see, yeah. There was
I wanted to ask you, if I could interrupt for a second, how did you get the name Clarence Phillips? Were you named after somebody?
Well, will you I'm almost about to go and tell you something. Well, you tell me, where did all the black folks get their names from? Do you know?
Yes. Well, the slave owners.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
But sometimes they took the first name from a relative. Like Clarence might have come from a great uncle, a grandfather.
Well, from stories that I read from time to time, tracing up my name, as trying to find, I found out the English people has settled my people's people and also my wife's people all settled down in the Southland, you see. But I'm not a Southerner. My wife is a Southerner, but I'm not a Southerner,
yeah.
You see. Not to consider that anything great. You see, my mother and father, they came from Delaware and Maryland. See, that's a part of the South, but and then as I studied the history, I remembered the what was his name, Governor Oglethorpe of Baltimore, Maryland. You see, I remember his name, and that part soon went away from me. I got to get back to get back to Leroy Locke and his family. Leroy Locke. Leroy never was married to that I knew anything of. And Mr. Webb, when I got 13 years old, I had to come out of the orphan home. I couldn't stay there. And in the meantime, this teacher, Ms. Locke, got a catalog from Tuskegee Institute, whereby my father said that Tuskegee was too far away for him to go and visit me in Alabama, and he wanted me to attend the school which would be nearer. And so the school that I attended, which was near, was the Bordentown Institute, you see, and that was called the Ironside. And that was it was a school on military bases. And so I went there in April 1905. I don't know what date April 1905. If I took time to think about it, I could tell it. But anyway, it was 1905 I went there, and was doing Easter time in April. You see, my father died July the 8th, 1905. But when I attended school and come there at Easter time, my initiation name was Easter. That was my nickname. They nicknamed me and they called me Easter School at the Bordentown School. That was a very nice school to go to. And the principal of that school was named Gregory. He had two children, as much as I can remember. He had a girl and a boy. I remember when the girl graduated from her school, I don't know what school she attended at the time, I remember me running around catching at this Bordentown school, catching butterflies. Give me a net and catch some butterflies, and she was catching butterflies and pasting them on a flame. She had to bring so many butterflies back to the college where she was attending. I don't know what college that she went to at all.
Actually, let me take this opportunity to turn the tape over because it'll run out.
Yeah.
And I don't want to interrupt you in the middle of a sentence.
Sure.
On side two, we're going to get back to the orphanage.
Yeah, we'll go back to the orphanage now.
Yes.
See, we've been in the dining room and we had something good to eat. Then when it comes to bedtime, we didn't make our beds. We could make our beds if we wanted to, but the cook and the matrons, they would go up and make the beds for we kids. There were so many beds in the main bedroom, and in the side bedroom there was one great huge double bed. and three and four wee kids slept in that bed. And I told my wife about it too. When the thunderstorm came up one night, because a terrible thunderstorm came up one night, and we kids were terribly scared of the thunder and lightning. Well, I was more scared of the thunder than I was the lightning. And I used to tell my father so many times that how I was scared of the thunder, make too much noise. So he told my father, is the one that told me, you don't have to be scared of the thunder. He says, you have to be scared of the lightning. See, because the lightning will strike you, see. So then I swung my ideas about being scared of the lightning, see. So we went on a picnic. We went on an outing from the orphanage, and we went to a theater to see the Punch and Judy show. Did I tell you about the Punch and Judy? We went to see the Punch and Judy show, and on our way back, up come a thunderstorm. Did I tell you that?
No.
Well, the thunderstorm came up, and we just got in the orphanage in time. Down come the rain, and torrents of rain. Whoa, the water just come like, I don't know what, but looked like the whole elements just opened up and dropped everything they had in it. And all of a sudden, a flash of lightning come like a bolt of lightning struck the home. And we kids went by being scared of the thunderstorm. We all were in the reception room and huddled all around these two matrons. That bolt of lightning struck the home, come down to the fireplace where we had all our stockings hung around the Christmas. They come down that fireplace, busted open that big iron plate that had where the fire go up, knocked that out, came on out through the dining room, went down the steps of the kitchen, out of the kitchen door, out in the yard, bang, and drove and went down and buried the stuff right at the kitchen steps in the play yard where we played.
And nobody was hurt.
Nobody hurt. And don't you know, as years rolled by, they didn't ever get enough dirt to fill that hole. They would put it in and smooth the ground all over, and by next spring it would be gone again. So now we've got the thunderstorm all straightened out.
But you would say your life at the orphanage was a happy part of your life.
I didn't have my wife.
A happy part of your life.
Yeah.
You enjoyed.
Yeah, the happy part of my life. I enjoyed the orphan home to such an extent that when we would go out to the outhouse, you know what the outhouse is?
Yes.
We'd get the plane all around in the yard, and maybe one of us had to go to the outhouse, so we'd go to the outhouse. And then when we come up to the outhouse, we'd always look and see how, because the building was four stories high. And we could look over three or four stories high, but we'd always look up there and see those nice big windows way upstairs there, way up there. But one day, we looked up there, and then all of us got together, the pretty all of them, everybody come out to see who was up there looking out the window at us. Did I tell you that?
No.
All right. Somebody was up there looking. Oh, we just had somebody up there looking. It couldn't be nobody up there. It just had to be somebody up there looking. And every time you holler about somebody up there, there'd be some more kids coming. And we'd all be looking at them. See him? There he is. Well, we older ones were there. One wanted to go up there and see that who that was up there. And me, my freshness, I went up there to see what it was. And I bet you don't know who was up there. You can't imagine. See, in those days, they made panes of glasses, you see. But the pane of glass that they made, it did have the face of a person in it. That's right. That was the funniest thing. When you get down on the ground and look up there, you could see him. It looked just like somebody was standing at the window looking at we kids playing. And I had the pleasure, I was one that had the pleasure of going up there, we called it going up in the attic. I went up in the attic because I wanted to see for myself. And it wasn't a thing but just the way they made window panes in those days. See?
Yeah.
You could see. It was just a flaw in the window pane. That's
well,
all.
What about, it could have been your children's imaginations, like seeing a face in the moon.
Well, when you're down on the ground, you look up there, it did look like somebody was looking at you, sure enough.
Yes.
You see? Because the stuff, that whatever they made glass out of in those days, it was purple, and it had color, just a little bit of color mixed in it, that it really looked like it was a person up there looking. And we looked at that for the longest time.
In those days, did you feel as though your father had a goal set out for you while you were at the orphanage, that he expected certain things of you?
No, my father never had now the only thing, he was just glad enough that I went to school. I'm coming to that goal part, but that's after I left off from home.
Yeah, I wondered, though, if that early.
Yeah. No,
you
I didn't
had
have
any feeling.
The only thing that I was great in doing in the orphan home, like Christmas coming, I had to draw, since I was one of the oldest ones there, I had to draw a Christmas tree on the blackboard and put all the bells and tinsel and stuff like that. Thanksgiving time, I had to be the one who draw the turkey on the board and on the blackboard. And then we had exercises like jingle bells, and then we had a song called I can't recall that, in relation to Thanksgiving. And then the story was told to us about how Thanksgiving became Thanksgiving. That was read to us by different women who would come to the orphan home.
And what about religion while you were at the orphan home?
The religion was Quakers. See? Don't care what nationality, what church you belonged to, it had to be, you had to be a Quaker there, because when they went out, they take everybody out to this Quaker home. See? And that was a very nice thing to see, because they would sit in that church in the building, in the Quaker meeting house, like knots on logs. Not a sound. Not a sound. The only thing you could hear was that clock, tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. And since I had become older and to realize what it was the Spirit of God that would strike different ones in this meeting who would get up and testify the goodness of God. Well, that was the nicest thing. And then after I had become a man and did testifying myself, I used to think it was a funny thing that people don't get it by being in an orphan home and seeing it done. I used to wonder why people don't get a church and testify the goodness of God. You see? But since I got older, I know better. But that was the nicest thing you'd want to see. How they sit there and hear nothing but that clock tick-tocking, and all of a sudden they get up and testify the goodness of God. What God did for them during the week or whatever it was, you know, testify.
Yes.
And sometimes two would get up sometime. And maybe if two got up, one would stop, but he would sit down, and the other one that got up would tell him, "That's all right, stay up there, that's all right. I'll be through in a few minutes," and then he'd go and testify the goodness of God. See? And that was nice to see.
How did your father feel about you going to a Quaker meeting house?
Oh, well, he was in for that. He knew where they were going, see, because he didn't live very far from the Quaker meeting house, and there's where we take that walk. Every Sunday, we take that walk around to the Quaker meeting house. And then when he told me that I'll take you there on the Monday, which was Sunday, went, and Monday, he had me there. And the next Sunday, I was walking with that gang going to that Quaker meeting house, you see. But then, since I come out of the Quaker meeting house and got to going into the world by myself, I didn't realize that there were two sets of Quakers. And I very near don't know the set of them yet. One was Hicksite, and the other was Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the Orthodox set, and one sang and the other didn't sing. You see?
And the one you went to didn't sing? The meeting house you went to?
The one I went to didn't sing.
Yeah.
So they were who?
I don't know. I'll have to research. I didn't know there was a difference.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So, are there any other highlights of your orphanage years?
I want to get to this boarding school in Bordentown, New Jersey.
Okay, before you get to it, let me ask you, how did you feel about leaving the orphanage before you went to Bordentown?
Well, I felt pretty good in leaving the orphanage because I didn't have no better sense than try to make money. I had a little bank. I never did get my bank after my father died. I brought my bank away from the orphanage home, but I don't know who got my bank because I had 14, as much as I could, in the orphan home, I had $14 in the bank. And my uncle came to see me, and he was in the Navy, United States Navy, and he gave me two silver dollars. I remember that. That made me have $16 in the bank. And I don't ever remember where the $16 of the bank went to. You see, and my father died, of course, and didn't nobody much care. The death of my father was caused by a barrel fell on him, and he never recovered. At least he handled barrel, and it seemed as though that this barrel or whatever they had there affected his back. I was well insured, so when my father died, the people who were paying the insurance, they didn't give me no money. I didn't get no insurance. I didn't get nothing that I knew of. Now, I'm coming out now. I left Bordentown School, by leaving Bordentown School, I went to South Woodstown, New Jersey. Did I give you any of that?
Well, tell us the year, just for the record.
South Woodstown, my father died September... 23rd of September 1905 is when my father died. July 5th, 1905.
Okay.
I went to these people, Richardson's, by the name of Richardson, September the 23rd, 1905. That's where it was.
Right. Now, and could you tell us how you got there?
Yes. I was introduced to the Richardsons by a woman whom my father went around as his girlfriend, Mrs. Louise Bryce. Mrs. Louise Bryce was my stepmother, you might as well say, or foster mother, she could be, who in turn got in touch with a family by the name of Richardsons. And Richardsons were glad to have me because Richardsons had quite a large grocery store in South Woodstown, New Jersey, and that was the only store there where people could come and buy, with the exception of going up into the town of Woodstown proper. Then they ran into larger grocery stores, but in this grocery store that the Richardsons had, they sold cigars, cigarettes, tobacco, and all kind of meats and groceries, all kinds of groceries. The favorite cigar that they sold, men used to be crazy about a favorite cigar that Richardson sold, called the shoe peg cigar, because every cigar had a shoe peg in it, and he couldn't smoke until he pulled the shoe peg out the end of the cigar, and then he could smoke. And then when my foster father come home, he was glad to know me and glad to see me. And he took me in charge and let me know. And then the school teacher in that town, she was from Millville, New Jersey, and her sister, the teacher's sister, was a opera singer. Let me let this man in. Now,
could you tell me something about the Richardsons themselves?
Yes, the Richardsons got a history. Now, that's going to take a little time to tell about them. Now, he was a Civil War veteran. And he never carried a gun in his life during the war. And he carried the United States American flag. And the first American flag, which is not published in the history books, first American flag was carried in the city of Richmond, Virginia, by Edward Richardson. When they attacked Fort Pillow, the soldiers were soldiers from Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and New York. Marilyn and Della, the soldiers, the army consisted of those, the regiments and all, was consisted of soldiers from Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, and New York, and New Jersey. Richardson was very nice people. As he being a soldier, he taught also in the army. And one word I remember he telling us about that he thought he knew it, but he found out later as years progressed, was tomato. And one of the boys who was trying to spell, learn how to spell, he brought the word up to him and said, "Hey," he says, "what does T-O-M-A-T-O-E-S spell?" And my father told him, he says, "I don't know," he said, "but it looked like tomatoes." That's what father was telling that. Not so much for that. Then after the war was over, they went to fight and shooting and killing. My father had on the march, it's coming down to the Rio Grande River down in Texas. They had to park there all night on the banks of the Rio Grande River, and it was dark, as pitch dark when the soldiers landed there. And the only thing that my father observed while they were laying out there in the weather, he saw a cannonball coming directly to him. And when the cannonball got to him, he says he doesn't know what the matter, but the cannonball killed a soldier right next to him. And he says he was looking for the cannonball to hit him. He said, but the cannonball came and jumped over and hit the fella next to him.
Did your father know Richardson in the war?
Huh?
Your father didn't know Richardson.
My father? No, my own mother. No, I call Richardson my father.
Oh, I see.
See? Because after my father died, but then I was put with these Richardsons
right.
to raise
okay,
me and educate
I
me.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I got away from that. He killed a fellow, and so that was all right. But my father never carried a gun. My foster father, I'd say to you, he never carried a gun. And so therefore he had seven flags. That's another thing. He had seven American flags shot out of his hand during the march up to Fort Pillar in Richmond, Virginia. But they managed to get there. When they got up to the fort, the soldiers all yelled out, "Fort Pillar! Fort Pillar!" And my father said, "You've never seen a bunch of men running like rats to the hole." He said they were running and getting out of there, he says, and the guns were shooting like time. And my father said he looked back, looked down the road. See, they had to go up the hill to get to Fort Pillar. And when he looked down the road, he said that whole road, as far as he could see, was covered with dead soldiers. They didn't have time. He said they didn't have time to pick them up. And just with the march right there. Well, so much for the funeral. And then, after I got off of South Woodstown, New Jersey, and went to the house there, then the teacher stayed at the Richardson's house. Her name was ABC. We call her ABC teacher because her name was Abigail something. But her name was Anna Bueller Corse. That was the teacher's name. Yeah, that was her name, Anna Bueller Corse. And then we always called the ABC teacher.
She came to the home to teach you?
She came. No, we had to walk. I walked about, I walked about a half a block to the schoolhouse. The schoolhouse sit off the edge of the road in the country. The schoolhouse was in the country schoolhouse. But it sit off. And they had also outhouses attached to that schoolhouse. No toilets was in there. And they had the big egg stove sitting in the center of the schoolhouse. See, that teacher had to teach seven grades in that school. The primer, and the first, the second, and third, up to seventh grade. Then after you got to seventh grade, you were old enough to get out and go on for yourself or stay there and work do something around and throughout the community. If this is not, I'm not talking about off and home now. I'm talking about
right. Yes, you were about 13 or 14 years old at this time.
Sure.
Right.
Now, during my visit at the Richardson's, Mom Richardson asked me, did I know John Handy? And I told her yes. She says, well, I've got to go to a funeral this afternoon. There's a family of people that came to your home and got this John Handy out of my home where I was. See? But he died. He was taken suddenly sick with appendicitis. And he died. My father and mother, then they came back and they said, well, they seen colored people cry and mourn for the death of a person, but they said they'd never seen a white person cry so much as this white couple mourned over this colored boy. They loved him that much. Oh, then in the meantime, I was introduced to them, and they wanted me to go with them, but my father and mother wouldn't let me go with them. See, no, they told us to stay with us. See.
Did they have any other children, the Richardsons?
Oh, I'm getting ready to tell you about them now.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm coming all
around.
I don't
want to rush you.
See? So, that night, when Pop come home, Mama introduced me to him. And then Mama was telling me about all the children that they had. And they had five children. Hmm. And they all were educated. My brother, I call him brother. I had four girls and one boy. He was going to Purdue University, Lafayette, Indiana. And the baby sister was going to Trenton Normal School. Ella Richardson, the oldest girl, was teaching down in Atlantic City. Next to the oldest girl was teaching in Morristown, New Jersey. And then, let's see, it was four girls. How many girls are their name? And then the girl next to the baby girl, she was going to Cheney Institute in Pennsylvania. See? Now, they were all getting educated. Now, when I went there to live with them, the danger and the battle was over. The battle was when they graduated, when Richardson's kids graduated from the grammar school, that as far as they went in their education when they were in turn should go to the high school. And they never went to the high school until the kids came home and told the father, Mr. Richardson, we're not being taught. Oh, that's the time they threw the fat in the fire. And my father said, what? You're not getting taught? What are you going to school for? Go to school tomorrow. Go to school the next day. Now, don't you say nothing. Keep on going to school. What did you do when you went there? Said, we didn't do nothing but just sit down to the desk there and wait till 3 o'clock come for us to come home. We come on home. Nobody said anything to us. So when opportunity presented itself, he went up there to the superintendent of school and he says, I understand that my children have been coming here all the week and you haven't been teaching them anything. Your teachers haven't been teaching them anything. Oh, yes, Mr. Richardson. Yes, we're teaching them. He said, listen, wait a minute. He says, I have just as much right to believe my children as you have to believe your children. My children said they're not being taught. And he says, my father's fuzz was getting up then. And he says, I want my children to be taught. You understand? Let us not carry this thing any further. He says, because there'll be trouble. Well, he says, just to think that I wasted these many years going to Richmond, Virginia, fighting my battle in the Civil War, and I come back here, and he says, and you don't want to teach my children? He says, that almost makes me want to go fighting again. See? So that man seen my father's, the principal saw that my father's fuzz was getting up. He told me, says, yes, Mr. Richardson, we'll see that they get taught tomorrow. He says, let us not have any. Then my father's pulse started to drop down a little bit. He says, let us not have any trouble over this thing here. And he taught them. And as time rolled on, they graduated and they got in these different places. As I told you, where different ones went.
Yes.
See? Then I was there with the Richardsons all alone. So I was picking up magazines and things and reading them. And every magazine and things I'd pick up, it would say, draw me and send me in. See? And I was looking at different pictures in there. And I would draw the pictures of these women or pictures of these boys or something. And I would send them in, and I would get an average of 85. And one of them, like one time, I got the average between 90 and 95 out of some institution. And in the meantime, Ella, the oldest one, had written down to Hampton Institute, where that magazine I showed you, she had written down to them and told them about me, and because she had been already down and graduated from Hampton Institute herself. So that's why I went to Hampton Institute, on the strength of her being educated at Hampton.
Yes.
Well, that was great life for me, because my father, when drawing these things, my father said to me, look here, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to Hampton and take up a trade, or do you want to stay here and finish drawing these pictures? Well, the environment, as I think I told you before, I didn't like the environment where I was, you see. So naturally, I wanted to get away from there and go somewhere where there were strange people all together, and where I thought that people were doing something more than what they were doing where I was living, in the community where I was living. So they got me ready, and they took, I don't know how much money, I think it was $30-some-odd, but anyway, the money was pinned in my underwear next to my skin to make sure that nobody would rob me.
Well, before we leave the Richardsons, could you tell me something about what you did there in terms of working?
Richardsons?
Yes.
Now, I went to school as one.
Yes.
And I had what they call chores. You know what the chores are. I had to clean out the horse barn. I had to bed down the horse, put the bedding down for them when they come in. I also had to put feed in the manger, in the feed box, so they could have the grain and the hay. I had to feed the chickens. I had to feed the hogs, but I didn't have any cows to milk. Then I had to gather the eggs. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I always had to go, and when I get home from school, I always had to go and gather the eggs and clean out the hen house. That was about that. Well, if we had something like we had in fact there was 150 acres. We had the cherry trees, we had kefir pear trees, we had puckery pear, we had the apples, we had maiden blush apples, we had the cherries, we had two kinds of plum trees, green gage and purple gage, green gage and purple gage plums. I told you cherries, yeah. Now, I had to split wood every afternoon and bring the wood in and put it in the wood box. They had a wood box there behind the stove. That wood box had to be filled up so as to burn wood all night long. That was part of it all night long. The chunks, you know what a chunk is? Had to bring the chunks of wood in. They go in, the chunks of wood would go in behind in the living room, or living room or dining room. They use it for dining room too, because they had a dining room and they also had a living room with a piano and an organ, because the whole family was musical. Put these chunks behind this here chunk stove, but I would always get the biggest chunk that I could get and put in there, for that big chunk would keep the house heated all night long.
How big would that have to be?
Oh, a big around just the top of this table.
that's about 2 feet.
Oh, the trunk
long
that,
yeah. And about 4 feet high.
Well, about not 4 feet high. It all depends on, lots of times it depends on what size trunk stove they put in. Because some of the trunks that went in there laid down in the trunk stove like that. You see, they had a big round trunk stove. No square trunk stove, trunk stoves were round. So, if a long one was put in there, then we put two short ones in there, about a foot long or more, and put that in there. Now, they burn all night long. And that house was heated by a hole cut in the ceiling, just a little, yeah, just about the size of that lamp. Now that would be cut in the
That's
ceiling,
about eight and up, by eight.
Yeah, that would cut through the ceiling and cut through the floor in the bathroom. Now, the cabbage, beets, potatoes, onions were buried outdoors. Dig a hole, at least 6 foot long. And about 2.5 to 3 foot deep, and put all of that stuff down there in marsh hay. And fill that all in marsh hay and lay that food down in there. When it comes to the top, to bed cabbage is the last thing that my father would bury in the ground, because they put the cabbage in with the head down and then cover it with dirt, cover all the dirt all over, and let the root ends stick up. All you can see was just the roots end sticking up out this pile of dirt.
Who else helped you in the chores?
Oh,
your
no.
father did some.
Well, my father, when he come home, as far as the dig, what they call the kiln, K-I-L-N. Uh-huh. And in the kiln, my father would dig the kiln, and then the stuff that we would bring, the stuff that we would harvest, we'd bring that and put in the kiln. You see, we'd put potatoes, white potatoes went into the barn. The white potatoes were buried in the hay mow in the barn. Sweet potatoes was put in the bathroom in a tall box, about that high and about that wide. But that'd be about
so
six.
Saying about how many feet?
Well, the sweet potatoes, what did you put, six bushels of sweet potatoes in that box?
And what did they do with the produce? Did they sell it, or did they use it in their store?
Well, we did everything with it. We supplied those who wanted to buy potatoes, and then the people around there didn't have no kill. Like, my mother and father would sell them any amount of potatoes they wanted, a quart, a peck. They sell the penny's worth of pepper, penny's worth of salt, sell 5 pounds of sugar, or 10 cents worth of sugar, penny's worth of anything that they bring along. Like, my mother was selling. My mother had charge of store. My father didn't have a charge of store at all. They had scales there to weigh the food.
But yeah. How did you know what to do on the land?
Well, he was a farmer. See, my father thrashed grain. Did I tell you that? Yeah. Well, the grain, I mean, the thrashman outfit came from J.I. Case in Wisconsin. J.I. Case outfit. That was a steam engine. A steam engine and a thrasher machine, and we had to. In fact, my father had two steam engine outfit. He had a steam traction engine outfit, which came from, as I say, from J.I. Case, and then he had another steam engine that came from the Frick Engine Company, came from Reading, Pennsylvania. Now, as time rolled on, these agents going around throughout the country and these companies improving their machinery, there was a man came by and offered to trade in, offered to take the thrash machines that my father had, thrashing outfit, and trade in for gas engine outfit. Well, now the gas engine outfit was like the one of the steam engine outfits you had. We had a steam engine outfit that was portable, and the horses had to pull that. But the traction, we pulled the tank and the coal tender and the thrash machine with the traction engine, steam engine. I have to pause and tell you about my father. Now, the traction engine was nice to use, but my father knew so much about the traction engine that he was exploiting. And everywhere they go, they had to do what they call setting. You don't know nothing about setting. Well, setting is just like this is this as though this was the engine, I'll say. And
the chair.
That building there is a thrasher machine.
Okay.
That building.
That's about 20 feet away.
Yeah, or more. Sometimes it's longer than that. But okay. And then on the engine here, they got what they call the flywheel. The belt is put on the flywheel and reached down 200 feet or more to the thrasher machine. See, that belt is put on the thrasher machine first, and then we come up here and put on the flywheel of the engine. See, so the motor was running, the thrasher machine was running one day, and they tried to put the belt on. And they were trying to put the belt on, and in order to put the belt on, my father had to get up and almost straddle the flywheel in order that the belt would, when he pulled the belt, that it would run right on the flywheel and the thrash machine would start running. Well, this time he missed his cue. Instead of the flywheel going on the thrash machine, my father's leg went through the gears of the engine.
What happened? Did he lose his leg?
No. My father never wore a pair of socks in his life, because when they were fought in the Civil War, he'd take the socks off, and he would always fill his leather boots. My father wore leather boots during the Civil War, so he'd fill the leather boots with cold water, you see? So this time, he had leather boots on when his leg went through the machine. But he had the presence of mind to hit a certain lever on the motor and to throw it in reverse, and that brought his leg out of the gears.
Did you see this?
No,
I've heard about this.
Yeah, but I saw his leg, because when I went with him, his leg, he showed me his leg where the nicks of the teeth of the cog had gone in his leg.
Oh.
Gone in his leg. Now, I'll tell you another incident. I was at school one afternoon, and my mother sent a boy at the school and told the teacher to send me home right away. When I got home, there was my father laying on the couch, all bandaged up, tied up. He was sawing wood at a farmer's place, and at my home, the farmers feed you, see? So they all had gone in to dinner. And Pop told the men, oh, you all going to dinner. He says, I've got just a little bit more to fix on the engine here. And said, this was a gasoline engine then. He says, and I'll be right there. So he went around back at the engine to cut it off. And the wind was blowing. And it blew his coattail. No. Yeah, it caught the rocker arm. They had a rocker arm going like that there.
Yeah.
And it caught his coattail. And he snatched his coattail away. When he's, you know, the devil is busy sometime and all through life. When my father snatched his coattail away, that rocker arm grabbed his sleeve. That's a fact. And now, I didn't see that. They all told me, the people there all told, they picked this rocker arm, picked him up, and was still running that, because he had gone there to shut the motor, and that he didn't get a chance to cut the motor off. It picked him up and took his arm right, stood all the way back, right out, and pulled it all out of the socket.
That's all.
It didn't pull it off, but pulled it out of socket, and then dropped him, and then the motor stopped. And they all at the house there was wondering why it didn't come. When they all came out of the house from eating dinner, my father was laying on the ground. So then they called up the house. My telephone number, if you care to know it, was 59W.
I can't believe your memory.
Come to telephone. And you had to ring it up there to get the operator.
Crank it up.
And crank it up. And she told her, they told my mother what's happening. My mother sent a boy down to school and told the teacher to let me off. So the teacher let me off. And then my mother had to get in touch with my sister, who was teaching in Morristown, New Jersey. Now, this is what country folks do for you. It's nice to live in the country. Don't you know that my sister got in touch with somebody connected with the railroad company? Don't you know they sent a special train down that one track place to take my father to the hospital?
Yeah.
Yeah, took him to the hospital. And
how old was he then?
Oh, he was in his, he was somewhere around near in his 80s. Somewhere near his 80s, sure. Now, we done got him out the hospital, and there's where he learned to write instead of right hand. Right, he used to write right hand. Then when the arm got caught, there's where he learned to write left hand. Then when he came out of the hospital, he could write either way. And when those nurses put socks on his feet, he told them, take them off, because I don't wear no socks. I wear boots. See? All right, so
well,
much for that.
Who helped him once he got older, you know, into his 70s and 80s? Who then did the field?
Well,
and the
you see, by us having the portable steam engine, he had a man to run the portable steam engine, you see,
yeah.
To go about the country thrashing. And my father took care of the expense of that. And the thrashing machine, my father run the thrashing machine himself, clear until he got the gasoline engine outfit where he tried in, you see. Because where he traded in, I meant to say.
Yes.
The it was altogether different. See, because when he got the gasoline engine outfit, then we could use the horses, and then we also got rid of the portable steam engine where we used horses. So we used the horses on for both of them. And we only had just the gasoline engine for the horses to pull around the country.
Right.
And we filled silos, we moved houses and barns, we sawed wood, and we thrashed grain.
And you would date that around 1910?
Oh, that went on from 1910 till I left for Richardson in
1914.
I came out in 1914. I graduated in 1914.
So this must have been in the early 1900s.
No, 1900, 1905, because you see, I came from.
You went there in 1905.
I went to Richardson in 1905.
So all this happened. You lived with them for 5 years between 1905
yes.
and 1910.
Yeah.
Okay. And when did Mr. Richardson die?
Richardson died when I was on a farm in Richardson, New Jersey. I was working on a farm then.
Yeah. So about 10 years after you left them?
Yeah.
And did they have expectations for you?
Who?
The Richardsons. Did they want you to go on and
get more training? Yes, yes. The way the oldest daughter who was graduated from Hampton, she's the one that suggested that I take agriculture, you see. So I took agriculture. I'm so glad. I've got something to show you, too.
Oh, good.
I'm so glad.
Let me see how much tape I have here. You know, look, we have maybe about 2 more minutes on this reel, so let me end the interview for today and look at the materials that you have, and we'll start on that next time.
Okay.
Is that agreeable?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Everything's agreeable.
Good.